The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Well, we have to be awake for this particular topic because I'm going to talk about awakening. And you can't be asleep when you're listening to awakening. So the path we're on, this path of meditation, insight practice, mindfulness, whatever you want to call it, Vipassana, a rose is sweet by any name, it goes somewhere. There is a destination. It goes somewhere, this path. And where it goes is awakening or enlightenment. It's often translated as enlightenment in the past, and there are many other words that are used for it. Which I'll talk about the choice of words more in a moment. But the first thing is that we don't usually talk about enlightenment or awakening very much in this tradition, or actually in any tradition. And it almost sounds like, it feels like it's a taboo to talk about nibbana, awakening, enlightenment. I'm just curious how many people have felt that, how many people have practiced it. Well, there's not a lot of discussion, yeah. So there is a reason for that, of course. There's a very good reason for it. And one reason is given that this practice has come from monasticism, from monks from 2,700 years, there is a Vinaya rule. There's a monk's rule. Vinaya code of monastic rules, lots of monastic rules. So there is a monastic rule about monks not being able to claim any attainments to lay practitioners, not being able to discuss what their attainments are, what stage of enlightenment they are, etc. So, and it's considered an offense, a gross infraction, if they lie, of course, about what their attainment is. And it's even considered a minor infraction, even if it's true, even if they really are at a particular stage, it's still an infraction. They're not supposed to talk about it to lay people. So as I was preparing this talk, I was curious about that. So when I looked it up, it's actually the reason makes sense. The reason is the Buddha didn't want lay people to favor one monk over another and give one monk food and alms, and the other one, you're not as enlightened. I'm just going to give all the food to the enlightened one so that there's more merit. There's the idea of merit generation in this practice. So imagine that, you know, the lay people would have preferences. So the Buddha said, just no, you're just not going to discuss any attainments you have at all. So that's one reason. So even as lay practitioners, there is a sense of not discussing. And of course, there is a good reason for it, because it doesn't make sense. Of course, if there is a healthy way to discuss it, then there's an unhealthy way to discuss it. The unhealthy way would be, "Hey, I'm enlightened," or it's just which is ew. Doesn't make sense, right? It's an oxymoron. If you're actually awakened, if there's enough wisdom in your arising, then there would be enough wisdom for there not to be conceit to try to show it off, right? So it kind of makes sense that it's not really a topic that's really discussed in that way. And yet, there is a constructive way and really supportive way to still bring it in, to talk about it, to know that, yes, this practice has a destination. We're not just sitting and walking willy-nilly for no reason, and that this practice goes somewhere, it unwinds, it naturally leads somewhere, just like the stream, just like the streams and the rivers lead to the ocean. The simile is this practice, it leads to the ocean of awakening, nibbana. So my hope for offering this talk tonight and the various things that I will be covering tonight, some of them are kind of nitty-gritty and some are more general, My hope is to provide a reference point and inspiration for this practice. I have to tell you that as I was preparing this talk, I actually felt really inspired myself to really up my own practice. Like, wow, there's so much more. This is exciting. So that's my hope in offering this talk, and in a way to provide inspiration, aspiration, which is uplifting, which is like your North Star. When you have a North Star, you set it, and then you don't check it every 5 minutes. You just kind of like, you're going towards it, right? And my hope is not to set up any expectations. And there's a difference between expectations and aspiration. So aspiration is a sense of uplifting. It's an orientation in life. It's this North Star that you set. You set your compass, and then you're just going that way without striving. Expectation is kind of tight. It's like bearing down. I want this to happen. I want this this medal. I want to put the medal of awakening on my chest. Ta-da. It's tight. It's comparing, it's needy, it's incomplete. So my hope is not to give rise to that sense of striving with this presentation, but a sense of aspiration, kind of keeping it, that this is possible. So as you listen to this talk tonight, my invitation is to listen to it the way Rilke suggested to the poet Franz Kappes in Letters to a Young Poet. Rilke wrote about living and loving the questions themselves. So as I will pose lots of questions tonight, lots of ideas, and I invite you to live and love the questions and not try to seek answers necessarily. Just live the questions. And this is what Rilke says. Let this wash over you. I want to beg you, as much as I can, dear sir, to be patient towards all that is unsolved in your heart, and to try to love the questions themselves, like locked rooms and like books that are written in a very foreign tongue. Do not now seek the answers which cannot be given you, because you would not be able to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps you will then gradually, without noticing it, live along some distant day into the answer. So live and love the questions themselves. And may we all someday, some distant day, live into the answers by living and loving the questions themselves. Yes? We have agreement, shall we? Okay. All right. All right, so now let's embark. Okay. So first I want to give you the punchline of the talk, so that if you fall asleep, at least you have the punchline. So the punchline is, you know, there are lots of different ways of understanding awakening, even within this tradition, which I will discuss, which could be interesting. But the punchline is, no matter how you understand the process of awakening, enlightenment, nibbana, it's really not about getting anything. It's not about attainment. Attainment is kind of a funny word that's been translated. It's really about letting go. That's what it's about. It's about letting go. And it was well captured by this talk years ago. There was a famous monk who started his talk, and he had been a monk, I don't know, for 30, 40 years or something like that. So he started his talk by saying, you know, I've been a monk for 30, 40 years, and I haven't got anything out of this. So the audience goes, what? Is he complaining? Is he going to disrobe? And then he continues to say, I haven't got anything, but I've let go of a lot. I've let go of greed. I've let go of conceit. I've let go of all my crazy ways of thinking. I've let go of so much. So I haven't got anything, but I've let go of so much. So the punchline is, awakening is about letting go, is about what we let go of. all the things that are extra, we're kind of heavy, we're carrying in our hearts, in our minds. It's about letting go of those. And how that happens, the different models I'll talk about a little bit. So now you've got the punchline. It's really about letting go. It's not about getting anything. What's that? Later. So the word in Pali is Nibbana. You might have heard the Sanskrit Nirvana. There was a band, famous band years ago. Nibbana, same word in Pali. And Nibbana is translated to many different words. It's actually the most often translated word for it is enlightenment. And for me, that was my least favorite translations until a couple of weeks ago, until a few weeks ago. I was moderating a panel, actually, on enlightenment at the conference on Buddhism in Berkeley, and at Gill and Norman Fisher and Ayananda Bodhi and Richard Dixie as the panelists. And I learned, because as I was expressing, this is not my favorite translation, I learned from Norman Fisher that actually the reason why it was translated to the word enlightenment, Nibbana was translated to the word enlightenment, is a nod to the intellectual and cultural movement of 17th and 18th century, the Enlightenment movement, which stresses reason, logic, criticism, and freedom of thought over dogma, blind faith, and superstition. Now I like the word enlightenment as a translation of Nibbana, because that it's about your own experience. It's about your own practice. It's your own freedom of thought. Freedom is a nice word. Instead of dogma or blind faith or this is what it's going to be like. No, it happens for you. It's very individual. So that's one way to relate to it. There are other words. The word that I also still like is the word freedom, because we get more free when we put down all the extra things that are heavy and we're carrying around. Imagine if you were carrying boulders in your back and rocks in your pockets and your backpacks, and it's heavy, and then you put it down. There's a sense of lightness, there's a sense of freedom, there's a sense of ease. So the word freedom, the word awakening, I also like that word, because it feels like you're waking up to another way of seeing yourself, relating to yourself, another way of relating to reality, the world. So awakening, as if from a dream, as if from a haze of confusion. There are 33 synonyms for Nibbana in the suttas. And I'll just read a few of them so that you get a taste of some other ways that the Buddha refers to awakening Nibbana in the suttas. And the words are the unconditioned, the destruction of lust, hate, delusion, the truth, the other shore, the subtle, the stable, the peaceful, the deathless, the sublime, the auspicious, the amazing, the wonderful, dispassion, purity, freedom, non-attachment, the island, the refuge, the destination, and the path leading to the destination. So, in the talk tonight, I'd like to discuss... First, I'd like to discuss a few different models within this tradition. So there are three different traditions of Buddhism. There's Theravada, which is early school, which is what we are in the Theravada tradition, the early school. Then there is the Mahayana, and Zen and Chan belong to the middle school, the second school. And then there's a late school. There is the Vajrayana and Tibetan, Dalai Lama, they belong to the third school. So there are three schools of Buddhism, and they all have different teachings, and some of them have more rituals and some have less. The early school is kind of bare bones. The late school Tibetans have a lot more rituals. So the three different schools, they have different teachings and conversations about awakening. But even within this tradition, within Theravada, there are three or four different ways to understand awakening. So I just want to touch into those for you briefly. So one is the Burmese model, which is based on the Abhidhamma. And the Abhidhamma, the Visuddhimagga, the path of purification, those are provided the training for all the Burmese teachers, the Abhidhamma-based. Abhidhamma is the commentarials that show, that really came to being about 500 or so after the death of the Buddha, pulled together by Buddhaghosa, Visuddhimagga was. Anyway, teachers such as Mahasi Sayadaw and my teacher Pak Sayadaw are in that tradition. And Mahasi Sayadaw was the teacher of Jack Hornfield, Joseph Goldstein, and Sharon Salzberg, and Jack was a teacher to Gill. So that's kind of like that's where it's coming from, right? That's kind of one. And then there is the Sri Lanka model, which is based on the suttas, which are the early, which are, again, it's all oral tradition, but supposedly what the Buddha said, not the commentaries, which are later on. So there's that model. And then there's the Thai forest tradition, and Ajahn Chah, who was Jack Hornfield's teacher, and Ajahn Sumedho, Suchito Pasano, and Amaro, whom you might have heard or seen their books, they're in the Thai forest tradition, and there's another understanding there. And I recently read a paper that Gill had written, so he's offering another understanding of Nibbana. So I'm going to offer those four very quickly before moving on to the stages of awakening. So with the Burmese Abhidhamma model template, so there is path and fruition, the idea of path and fruition, which also, by the way, exists in the suttas, in what the Buddha taught himself. So it didn't just get introduced in the commentaries. So in both the sutta and the Abhidhamma, there is the path and fruition moments that have to do with moments of awakening. Okay. Now, in the Burmese model, so it's called Magga-pala. Magga is path in Pali. Pala is fruition, path and fruition. So in the Burmese model, in the Abhidhamma model, the path moment, that's the moment that it's kind of like a stroke of lightning, and it's kind of cuts the root of it doesn't repeat. There's only one path moment for for each of the four stages of enlightenment, and it's that moment that's a super mundane consciousness. It's thought of, and it cuts the root of defilements. And I'll share with you what the defilements are that get dropped at every stage. So path moment is the bang, and fruition is what then one enters into to re-experience. It's to kind of re-experience the bliss, the bliss of the moment of awakening. But it's not productive. It doesn't get rid of any more defilements. It doesn't uproot. And the path and fruition, the fruition immediately follows the path moment. So that's the Abhidhamma model. And also the idea is that there is a cessation. So there is a cessation. So it's thought of as there's a gap in consciousness, but it's actually better understood as the supramundane consciousness takes Nibbana as its object. And I'm just going to let that be So I'm not going to explain that any further. But in a way, I think the way to relate to that, okay, maybe I'll explain, the way to relate to that is that there is still consciousness, but it's not a normal consciousness in that moment. The consciousness has opened up to Nibbana as object. So Nibbana is thought of as not being an ordinary state, not being within the five aggregates, being out of that. So basically, I think the way to relate to it is that the mind in that moment, consciousness opens up to something it's otherworldly. It's really otherworldly in that moment. So moving on to the sutta model, so now we still have the Magapala, we have the path and fruition, but now path happens at some point in your practice when you become a dedicated practitioner. And fruition is the lightening moment. That's the one that actually is very productive, and it cuts the roots. So, and the way to understand, by the way, these moments is, see, you've been practicing. So if there was a thick rope, and you know ropes are made of lots of tiny little smaller threads, the thread is getting cut, and there's just one little thread holding the two sides of the rope, yeah? So the idea is that in that moment when the practice is really, really strong, that's what gets dropped. That's what gets disconnected, what is put down. So it's not that everything happens in that moment, but it's all of your practices leading up to that moment. It's so threadbare that something opens up, something gives. So in this model, the fruition moment can happen years after the path moment. So you can't miss the fruition moment, but the path, the idea here is that when you're really established in the practice, you're a dedicated practitioner, the path moment happens. So many of you might have had your path moment without knowing that you've had a path moment. And the understanding is that when a practitioner has had a path moment in the sutta model, they'll definitely have a fruition moment in this very life. That's inspiring, right? Yeah? So, moving on to the Thai forest tradition. So the Thai forest tradition, there is a point of contention between the Thai forest tradition about what Nibbana is and the two other traditions. So in the Thai forest tradition, the idea, there is an unconditioned awareness that is thought of to be the state of awakening. So awakening or Nibbana is associated with a state of consciousness. A consciousness that's not an ordinary consciousness, and you can just rest and abide in it. So I won't get into controversy. There's plenty of different monks kind of like, it's this way, it's that way. I think the point is there are awakened beings in every tradition, in no matter what you subscribe to. It doesn't really matter the model. There are people who share from their experience, and really they have put down the fetters there from their practice, from the way they are in the world. They you see that they have changed. So I want to give a nod to also what Gill is proposing as Nibbana as an action, not as a thing or a state, which these other models are talking about Nibbana being a thing or a state. So what Gill is proposing is that the word Nibbana and the verb Nibbayati, which means cools, becoming calm, ceasing to burn, ceases to blow, is the idea of like going out like a light or cooling, extinguishing. So it's an action. So he says these are action verbs. So when we talk about nibbana, it's really being nibbanized. So all the greed and hatred and delusion are being nibbanized. They're being cooled. They're being extinguished. So nibbana is really an action. It's a doing. It's not a state that you rest in. And he points out lots of different sutta references where, for example, when Buddha is referring to his own awakening, he says, it's hard to see the state, namely the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all attachments, the destruction of craving, fading away, cessation. And he points out that these are all verbs, stilling, relinquishment, destruction, and fading. None of these are states. These are all activities. These are all activities. So no matter what the model is that one is practicing in, it doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter. And maybe it matters, but maybe it doesn't matter that it matters. So what really matters, again, I want to go to the punchline, is what is relinquished, is what is put down. Because that's what all the traditions and all these models I talked about, they agree on. So let me go to that now. What really matters is how you get changed, how you become different. So in fact, it's almost like mounting a summit. René Dumas from Mount Analog, the book Mount Analog, says, "You cannot stay on the summit forever. You have to come down again. So why bother in the first place? Just this. What is above knows what is below. But what is below does not know what is above. One climbs, one sees. One descends. One sees no longer. But one has seen. There is an art of conducting oneself in the lower regions by the memory of what one saw higher up. What one can no longer see, one can at least still know." So the idea of practicing for these openings that one does not see anymore, but one is changed. And how is one changed? It's really, that's the question. That is why we practice. It's not to have these medals on our chest, but how do we get changed? What do we put down? What goes away? So what really, in the first stage, so there are four stages of awakening. The first stage, the stream entry, what is put, there are three things that are put down, are let go of, changes that happen. One is the identity view goes away. So there's kind of a relationship that one has to oneself, taking oneself so personally, so seriously, believing every thought that comes up, all our habitual, what do I call, neuroses. So one ends up having a different relationship to oneself. Another one is that any doubt or uncertainty about this awakening, about this process, about the teachings, about that this is the path, that this really leads to letting go of suffering, that goes away. It's like, yeah, this works. Not only this works, but I can do it. So doubt goes away. Doubt completely goes away. And also, there's a firm commitment to the five precepts that arises. And it's said that after the first stage, the stream enterer cannot do any major infractions of the five precepts. You know, there could be minor infractions, like a small lie here or a glass of wine here, but any major hiding of any major misdeeds, it just cannot be done. Because, think about it. It doesn't make sense, right? When you kind of see what, then you kind of like you have a glimpse of your own true nature and the world's true nature. you don't want to kill and steal and lie. It just doesn't make sense anymore. So, and the third thing that drops is attachment to rites and rituals. And that's kind of the sense of beliefs that if I do this, if I, you know, do this chant for 100 times, oh, then I'll become enlightened. Or, the, you know, you just know that you know what it takes. It's not rites or rituals. And at the time of the Buddha, there were lots of rites and rituals. Like there was the dog practice where people practiced like a dog. They went around and barked and didn't wear clothes. And they thought that by acting like a dog, they're ridding themselves of their defilements that way. Or they had the bark cloth practice. They just wore a bark cloth and they didn't eat anything. So these practices, rites and rituals, instead of actually looking within, inside, outside, the practice of the inside practice. The second stage of awakening, the once returner. Oh, and a stream enterer, by the way, it's said that after this stage, you can only have 7 rebirths until you have full awakening. So that's why the next stage is called once returner, which means you only have a human rebirth just one more time. The two things that get attenuated in that stage, one is sensual desire, and the other one is ill will. They get attenuated in second stage. So nothing drops in the second stage. These are so sticky that just get attenuated. In the third stage, they get dropped. In the third stage, which is known as the non-returner, anagami, sensual desire and ill will completely drop. And in the fourth stage, the arahat, the last stage, then the remaining 5 fetters drop. One is attachment to the 4 meditative absorptions, or the jhanas, the state, the absorptions, the rupa jhanas, the ones that are material jhanas, as well as 7 is formless absorptions, because they're so delicious, they're so wonderful, but at that stage, any attachment, any desire for them drops. 8, what gets dropped, 8 is conceit. And conceit here, mana, is not a sense of, it's the regular conceit, the conceit of I am. Joseph Goldstein likes to call this I was, I am, I will be. So this sense of the self being the center of the narrative of the universe, it's that sense of conceit of I am that gets dropped. And what's different about that and the identity view, which gets dropped in the first stage, identity view is you relate differently. It's a sense of anatta, it's not self. But you're still the center of your own narrative. But it's the stage, the last stage, that the conceit drops. And then restlessness drops in the last stage. So if you have restlessness, that's going to be around for a long time. I'm sorry. And then the 10th and last thing is ignorance. And ignorance, avijja, which is kind of I think of ignorance as not knowing any better. You know, if we knew better, we would do better. It's kind of similar to the Christian prayer, forgive them, Father, as they do not know what they do. It's kind of the sense of ignorance. If we knew better, we wouldn't do the things that we do that hurt other people, that hurt us. We wouldn't be greedy or hateful. If we knew better, we wouldn't hurt ourselves. We wouldn't hurt other people. So that's the root of all ills in the world, is ignorance. If we really knew our true nature as human beings, we wouldn't do the things we do to harm ourselves, others, the environment, etc., etc. So really, what's significant about awakening, again, it's not the model or what happens. I just wanted to give you a sense of these differences, but what really matters is how the person is changed. And if one goes to one of the masters or a teacher nowadays and say, oh, this is what the experience I had, and this happened, and that happened, and what the masters would say and continue to say is, okay, let's see your behavior in a year or 5 years. And that's the way it is in Zen, apparently. And so how are you going? How is your behavior? How is your personality? How are you going to be changed 5 years from now? That's when we know if this woo, this experience, this Big Bang experience you had, whether it was just an experience or whether it really changed you. So that's how I suggest you hold it. It's not about experiences. Experiences are a dime a dozen. You can take drugs and have experiences. But how are you changed? How are you kinder? How are you more wise? How are you more gentle, more patient towards towards yourself, towards other people? I'd like to read a couple of excerpts. So this is an excerpt I like to read to you. And I find this very inspiring. This is from Ajahn Liam, who was reported to be awakened. And this is a report that was written about how the experience came up and how it feels for him. So let this wash over you as an inspiration. He says the meditation was very peaceful, and then the reflection came up for him. So the reflection, so this is this reflection that then kind of like unwinds the rest of it. So the reflection is, we don't practice for anything. We practice for the sake of practice. That's really profound, right? To think that this is the statement that unrolls his unwinding, unbinding. We don't practice for anything. We practice for the sake of practice. So this is what kept coming up for him. This would be a wonderful thing to drop into our meditation, wouldn't it be? We don't practice for anything. We practice for the sake of practice. So here he goes. Keeping this teaching in my mind, I kept on meditating. Normally, I would sit in meditation until about 10 or 11 p.m. and then stop to have a rest. But on this day, I continued sitting for about 8 hours without moving or making the slightest change in posture. He must have been very concentrated. With this experience of peace, the mind changed. The feeling of peacefulness shot up and pervaded throughout the whole body as if something were taking hold over it. It felt cool, a coolness that suffused the whole body, so very cool, an experience of the whole body becoming completely light and at ease. The head felt so cool the whole day and night, as if there was a fan blowing over it. Cool, peaceful, quiet, and still. No experience of thoughts at all, and no clue at all where they had disappeared. Everything silent, completely. It felt totally quiet. The only experience left was that of utter peace and stillness. The body felt tranquil and light. This experience continued on throughout the whole year, not just for a day or two. In fact, it has continued on unchanging for many years, all from that one go. There is the state of coolness, as if in the brain, whether sitting or lying down, coolness in every position, all worries, concerns, or similar thoughts from the thinking mind are totally gone. Seeing somebody, I just had the feeling of seeing it as absolutely normal, to see a person as simply a person, just that much. No beautiful person, no ugly person. People simply would be specifically the way they were. This is the kind of peace and tranquility that arose. I try to recall and pin down that which is called dukkha. Dukkha is the word for suffering. What is it? I really don't know. I only know how they discern the meaning in terms of conventional language, because dukkha is just something created by common conventions. When the mind has no dukkha, all conventions whatsoever don't exist in the mind, and the experience of this feeling has lasted on continuously all the time since then. I love reading that, hearing that, the sense of no stress, no dukkha, all gone, all gone. It is possible. And our practice, what we're practicing, whether there is the big bang, little bang, but it changes us little by little. So this metaphor of this rope and the threads, you know, as we keep practicing, as we see, keep sitting and walking, we are being nibbanized. Little by little by little, these threads keep getting cut more and more and more and more and more and more. And maybe someday it gets cut completely. But as we do the practice, trust that more and more of the thread is being cut. You're being nibbanized little by little by little. That's where this practice is going. So let's just sit together for a moment. And as we are sitting together in silence for a moment, I'd like to invite you to think about one thing you might be taking home from this talk. Perhaps something that inspired you or you learned you'd like to take forward in your life, in your practice. Something to support you. May all beings be happy. May all beings be free. Taste freedom, including us. Thank you for your kind attention. I will stay if there are any questions.